A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to like get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
When you actually study Jewish law, the very quote and nitpicky nature of it actually is setting a very high bar for love. So you have this very specific law that says if you go into a store and you have no intention of buying anything, don't ask the shopkeeper for the price of an item because you're just wasting their time and getting their hopes up. There's another law that says if you loan money to someone who's really financially struggling and a couple of weeks later you happen to see them coming down the street towards you, you should actually try to avoid running into them because if you do, if you know they still can't pay you back, you're going to embarrass them, right? You're going to stress them out. Now you could say like, come on. You can't just say treat workers well and help the poor. What you need these little nitpicky specific scenarios. But what Jewish law is trying to do with these hyper-specific scenarios is they're really trying to inculcate in you an exquisite sensitivity to the needs and dignity and humanity and specificity of every single person that crosses your path. They're really trying to get you to see that particular person.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and today we're kicking off a very special two-part conversation with author and former White House speechwriter Sarah Hurwitz. She was part of President Obama's speechwriting team, helping to craft some of his more memorable addresses, and she later served as the chief speechwriter for First Lady Michelle Obama, shaping many of her most powerful and beloved speeches. In recent years, Sarah has turned her considerable gifts towards exploring her own spiritual life and Jewish identity. Her latest book, which is fantastic and highly recommend you check it out, is called As a Jew, Reclaiming Our Story from Those Who Blame, Shame, and Try to Erase Us. She's also got some other books, including Here All Along, worth checking out. I will have all of that information, of course, in the show notes. But her latest book takes readers on that journey, asking deep questions about faith, community, and what it means to live a meaningful life. In part one of our conversation, we dig into the inspiration behind the book, Sarah's path from politics to spirituality, and the themes that make this work so timely and resonant. So without further ado, here's Sarah freaking Hurwitz. All right, welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. Sarah Hurwitz, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
It is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So before we dive in, I always like to have the guests talk a little bit about sort of, you know, their background and how they came into the work that they're doing today. So give the folks the little bio of who Sarah Hurwitz is and how you became an author, because we did start to talk about that a little bit. That was not your original destination. So talk.
It was not my original destination, actually. It's funny. I started my career in politics, believe it or not. I got my start as an intern in Vice President Al Gore's speechwriting office in the summer of 1998, which is definitely dating myself a little bit. And the writers I worked for helped me get my first two jobs in politics as an assistant to a speechwriter and a speechwriter, both of which were total failures. I didn't know how to write speeches. So I went to law school thinking, okay, I'm going to grow up, get a real job, never write speeches again. But in law school, I met a guy who'd previously been a speechwriter for President Clinton, who's now a congressman from New Jersey, Josh Gottheimer. But he was just my law school classmate back then. And we freelance wrote speeches together, got jobs on General Wesley Clark's primary campaign in 03. He lost. On Senator Kerry's campaign in 04. He lost. I got a job as a Hillary Clinton's chief speechwriter in 08. As you know, lost. So, you know, two failed jobs, three losing campaigns. And then I got very lucky and I got a job on then Senator Obama's campaign for president in 2008. And he won, which was this radical new experience for me. And, you know, on the campaign, I was there to write for him, but I helped Mrs. Obama with her 2008 Democratic Convention speech. And we really hit it off. She's just wonderful. I loved working with her. But, you know, I went to the White House to write for the president and I did that for about a year and a half. And then I just realized I missed writing for her. And I was kind of more interested in the topic she was talking about. So I made an unusual speechwriting and career move, moving from the West Wing to the East Wing and becoming the head speechwriter for First Lady Michelle Obama, which I then did for the rest of the 8 years in the White House.
Oh, man, that's such a wild story.
It was wild.
I must ask, because my favorite characters on one of my favorite shows of all time, The West Wing, are the speechwriters. Like, maybe we can pull some strings. Maybe Michelle can talk to Aaron Sorkin and be like, now would be a great time to give us some hope. You know, in the form
seriously. Oh my gosh, that show, I mean, so many people in the Obama White House had been inspired to enter politics by The West Wing. And I actually have to say they do a great job portraying speechwriting. Their speechwriters were very relatable. You know, you see them getting writer's block and getting stuck and getting burned out. It's quite well portrayed.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I always wondered because you see those shows and you're like, I don't know how realistic this is, but that's not the first time I've heard that about that show.
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, we weren't as good looking and clever, you know, walking around doing these witty repartee. But I think those characters' sense of incredible patriotism, of like love of country, their passion for service, and just the way they supported each other, that really was reflected in the Obama White House. It was a really, just really wholesome kind of place. You know, people were really earnest and just there to serve. And many of us stayed all 8 years, which is quite unusual. Usually people last about 18 months in the White House, but that was a pretty special place.
Wow. I missed the civility, let me tell you.
Same. Regardless of what party you are, I really do miss that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you've got a new book coming out and, you know, obviously we want to talk about that. And so starting at the very beginning, you open the book with the phrase, my humiliating Jewish identity. Can you unpack that for us? And what did Jewishness mean to you when you were younger? Because one of the themes that we talk about on the show is how, you know, our identity is so ingrained in our spirituality or our religion, and how, you know, a lot of the people on this show, particularly the deconstructionists, are people who have evolved in their definition of what it means to be Christian or Jewish or Muslim or whatever. So how did that look for you when you were younger?
Yeah, you know, I grew up like, you know, a lot of American Jews, where Judaism for me was three boring holidays, you know, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Passover, and then one fun holiday, which was Hanukkah. And it was two texts, the prayer book we held in our hand at the synagogue and the Torah that was on the scrolls at the front of the synagogue, which is the first five books of what Jews call the Tanakh and what Christians call the Old Testament. And a few universalist values like, you know, love the stranger, help the poor, don't lie, cheat, steal, and the Holocaust. And like, that was the Judaism to me. And, you know, it wasn't all that compelling to me. And I realize now I spent a lot of my childhood and young adulthood kind of almost apologizing for being Jewish. You know, people, I would say, oh, I'm Jewish, but I'm just a cultural Jew, which, you know, that is a beautiful way to be Jewish. You can connect to Judaism through Jewish thought, history, languages, literature, art, music, but I didn't know about any of that. Or I said, oh, you know, I'm just an ethnic Jew, which is a totally nonsensical statement because Jews are of just about every ethnicity and every race. We're actually quite a diverse population. So there's no such thing as an ethnic Jew or many ethnicities. Or I would say social justice is my Judaism, which is gorgeous, but social justice is also my Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and decent secular personism. Everyone believes in social justice. And Judaism, like those other traditions, does have its own unique approach to social justice, but I didn't know it. And like, I remember the Holocaust. I mean, come on, that is a depressing Jewish identity. So like, there's my Jewish identity. And at the age of 36, I broke up with this guy I was dating, and I was super lonely and anxious. And I happened to hear about an intro to Judaism class at the local Jewish community center. And I signed up just to fill time. You know, I thought, okay, I should know something about my culture or whatever. But what I discovered in that class was 4,000 years of radical, transformative wisdom about the human condition, about what it means to be human, how to be a good person and lead a worthy life and find profound spiritual connection that was not just God is a man in the sky. It's actually not what Jewish tradition says about God, shockingly. But I didn't know that because I didn't know anything about Jewish tradition. And that really started this journey of adult discovery. You know, I was very much a pediatric Jew, as the rabbi named Larry Hoffman calls it. He said, you know, many of us are pediatric Jews. We stop learning when we become bar bat mitzvah age, and then we're done. And I have to say, I would never say, oh, you know, I know everything I need to know about the indigenous peoples of America because of my sixth grade social studies class. I would never say, oh, I know what I need to know about Islam for my ninth grade world cultures class. I mean, you're talking about rich, deep, profound traditions, peoples, heritages. And the idea that you can learn about it as a kid and be set, it's not true. You know, you kind of have to grow up. And that's really what I did in my mid-30s. I then wrote a book about that, you know. And then, you know, some things happened that led to my second book. But my first book was really an account of my discovery of Jewish tradition. And I really wanted to share what I found, not just with Jews, but with people of all backgrounds who are just curious about the wisdom of these great world traditions. You know, I've learned so much from studying other religious traditions, and I was excited to share mine with others.
That's so interesting. I found that to be quite common, just in terms of like the timing. For me, it was the same thing. Mine was just born out of a sense of curiosity. I realized that for some people, when they're going through sort of a spiritual transformation, you know, because they got dragged kicking and screaming out of that path through some sort of tragic ordeal.
Right.
But for me, it was similar. It was, you know, I was just curious. And I was also in my mid-30s and at the end of my life where, like, for me, it was the transition in the sense of, like, I was becoming a parent for the first time.
Mm. Yes.
And so then suddenly I was like, I should probably know what I believe before I start raising this child, you know? And so I think that's such a common period, I think, in life, where you start to sort of ask questions and get curious and at least do the research.
Yes, exactly. And it was, you know, I was finally learning about this with my adult sensibility, and I got an adult take on it rather than, you know, when you're a kid, there's some, you know, you can do the holidays, you can do the fun stuff, but it's a lot more complicated than that. So I'm very grateful that I got to go on that journey.
That's awesome. So the breakup that pushed you into an introduction to Judaism, this class that you take, almost feels like fate, you know. What surprised you most in that first class?
Yeah, you know, it sort of breaks my heart to say this, but, you know, growing up, like, I knew what Catholicism said about, you know, about like contraception and abortion. I knew what various political parties said about crime, immigration, the economy. I had no idea that Judaism said anything about these topics. And what I discovered was, oh, wait a second. Jewish tradition has wisdom about every aspect of our lives, how we treat our bodies, how we conduct our business affairs ethically, how we speak. I mean, there's an entire body of Jewish law and thought about literally how you use your words, like how you speak in a way that shames or doesn't shame people. Do you spread gossip or not? And they have a very broad definition of gossip that was pretty sobering for me. You know, it was how do you treat your spouse, your child, your parent, your friend, your colleague, your neighbor? It was all of this daily wisdom for living. And I just thought, like, wait, where has this been all my life? You know, why didn't I know this existed? So I think I was just surprised by how, you know, I also didn't, you know, I thought that the Torah, you know, that was it. Like, that was the Jewish text. That was it. And then we stopped. But the Torah and the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, that's the beginning of Jewish tradition, not the end. The Jews spent 2,500 years debating, questioning, discussing, reinterpreting, reimagining, and we've issued millions and millions of pages of thought and understanding of our laws. So it's, you know, to sort of read the Torah and think, okay, I got it. That's Judaism. That's like reading the original draft of the Constitution and be like, okay, I get it. Slavery is allowed. Women can't vote. Okay, that's the Constitution. Like, no, it's really not, actually. Actually, it's really not. It's changed a lot since back then.
That's really funny that you give that example, because I'm literally in the middle of working on some episodes on questions that people asked forever ago, and I just did not have the time to dedicate to do it justice.
Yeah.
And one of those is how we read the Bible, how we approach the text, and things like context and understanding that some of this is metaphorical and some of this is genealogical and there's different styles of writing in there. All things as beautiful as it is, but things that you have to take in consideration when reading it, and the fact that, like, people probably far smarter than us for hundreds and hundreds of years have debated these very passages. And so, you know, it has to be handled with some level of care.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, coming to the Torah as an adult with some historical understanding, I now understand the Torah as a polemic. You know, this document is very much, and again, I'm talking about the first five books of what Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Tanakh. You know, this is a polemic against the oppressive, terrible values and practices of Egypt and Mesopotamia. You know, slavery, the abuse of the vulnerable, the worship of pharaohs and emperors and kings. You know, this is so much a polemic against this. You know, it's really a call to create a society that is the exact opposite of ancient Egypt, you know, where we care for the vulnerable, not the king, where we don't enslave people. Like, a really, you know, it's quite radical. But, you know, if you don't have that background, you just read it and you think, oh, this is kind of wild. Like, oh, this feels violent. This feels, you know, you just don't have the context you need to actually grasp the profound ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I remember the first time somebody pointed out, they're like, you know, what was so interesting about, you know, the God of Judaism, the God of Christianity, you know, the Abrahamic traditions, is that you look back and you compare that God's creation story versus others, and it's the only one that creates through peace, you know, not through conquest or violence. It's like, you know, God spoke it into existence and then it was good. And that was it. Yeah. You know, it's not God slaughtered his enemy and that they, you know, and established creation through an act of violence, but rather through peace. And, you know,
oh, it's so interesting. Goodness. Yeah. It's also, you know, what's so interesting. And there's a rabbi named Rabbi Jonathan Sacks who wrote so beautifully about this.
I love him.
He's, oh my God, his writing is just exquisite. You know, he talks about this incredible balance between the universal and the particular that Judaism has, where it's very clear all human beings are created in God's image, period. Right? Adam is not a Jew. Cain and Abel are not Jews. They are just people, right? So we're all created in God's image. And then at some point, God is like, okay, Abraham, we're going to have a particular relationship with you, which doesn't preclude me having a relationship with anyone else that looks different. But this is how our relationship looks. And this is how the relationship of the Jewish people look. And, you know, your son Isaac will, a great nation will come from him, and your son Ishmael as well, right? There is not this, you know, so it's like everyone is created in God's image and God can have particular relationships with particular peoples, and that's okay, right? That diversity of relationships is actually quite beautiful and profound. And I just that balance between universal and particular is, it's quite stunning.
It's so funny you bring him up because his book, Essays on Ethics, absolutely shattered me. Oh, my gosh.
It's so good.
His interpretation of Jacob and Esau is still, to me, is one of my favorite versions of that story because he made me look at it in ways that I'd never considered before. And really, I know what he was attempting to do because he also has a great book out, Not in God's Name.
Yes. Oh, it's about religious extremism. That book is phenomenal. So I think that was actually the first book of his that I read. And then I thought, I have to read everything this guy has written.
Yeah.
So he wrote a lot.
That was a sad day for me.
Oh, it was devastating. He left us way too soon. He was really one of the great voices.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I think is really interesting, I mean, your whole like story, your whole journey is fascinating because like, it's just really like, yeah, you're like, I'm on this journey and now I'm on this journey. It's really cool. One of the things you talk about is you're also trained as a hospital chaplain and my dad was as well. He worked for a long time. Experience some things I would never want to experience in a hospital.
Yep. Yep.
But like one of the things that's interesting is like, you know, just my experience from my dad working there is he worked alongside predominantly other Christian chaplains. You know, he was, you know, a Lutheran, but there was a Catholic chaplain that was there. And so he kind of used to talk to me about how they would work together on some common goal. And it was like this really cool relationship that he forged. But you would have been a Jewish chaplain. So what was that like in what is typically predominantly a largely Christian environment? And what did that teach you about that relationship?
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that you say this, that I did 4 units of clinical pastoral education, which is sort of the full training. And, you know, nearly all my classmates were Christian, and as were all my instructors. And I think the experience, you know, chaplaincy is totally multi-faith. There are chaplains of every faith background and secular humanist chaplains who are atheists. So very open and diverse. But, you know, again, we live in a majority Christian country. And I think something that I realized while doing this training was like, oh, we kind of speak Christian. We kind of, you know, even things like, okay, let's talk about our ministry. Let's talk about our theology. Or, you know, the thing that really got me was I was told, you know, prayer is, you know, God, please heal so-and-so who's right here in front of me. They can hear me praying out loud for them. I'm praying totally extemporaneously and spontaneously, which is a gorgeous form of prayer. And certainly Jews can certainly pray for each other that way if they'd like, but that is not a common form of Jewish prayer. And by the way, like some of my Catholic classmates were like, yeah, we don't really do that either. And my Muslim classmate was like, I don't think we do either. But it was sort of like, no, that's universal prayer. As long as you don't say Jesus, that's just what prayer is. I thought, like, interesting. And I began to think about things like spirituality. You know, the idea that, you know, the body is kind of carnal, is kind of, you know, it's materialist. It's sort of a little bit degraded, whereas the soul, the spirit is incorporeal. And that's kind of a higher thing. This kind of body, soul, body, spirit duality, that is not a central Jewish idea. But that was always my idea of spirituality. Spirituality is you transcend your body. End of story. But if you read the Torah, it's filled with laws and wisdom about how you treat your body. And the body is considered quite a sacred vessel in Judaism. So I thought, like, this is so, like, I approached Judaism through a Christian lens. Like, it was really interesting to begin to sort of see how that, you know, I was sort of soaked in this Christian language and way of approaching. And I approached my tradition, which is very different, with that background. And I think this is true of any person who's a minority in majority culture. You know, the majority's language, ideas, values, they really do kind of infuse your own life. And you start to approach yourself through that lens, which, you know, may or may not be helpful for actually understanding your own tradition.
That's a very good point.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this. Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
So you write about discovering that you had what you call, quote, the wrong keys, that you had absorbed Christian frameworks, is what we were just talking about, without realizing it. So, like, as you started to notice these subtle, like, influences, how did that shape your own view of your tradition?
Yeah, I mean, it made me kind of understand why I had grown up with the kind of Judaism I'd grown up with. And it made me take a really deep dive into history to understand that better. So something that's important to understand is that, you know, before in Western Europe, before the 1800s, Jews generally lived in totally, and in Eastern Europe as well, Jews lived in these very insular Jewish communities. You know, they live with other Jews, they live by Jewish law, they generally ran their own local governments, courts, you know, they lived by a Jewish calendar, they're quite insulated. And then, you know, in the 1800s, European countries started granting citizenship to people, including Jews. And Jews were like, well, wait, if we want to go to these universities and get these jobs and be part of modern society, we got to figure out a way to be Jewish that doesn't involve being totally segregated. It can't be this 24/7 thing. And so they actually reconceived Judaism as a peoplehood to a religion, to more of a religion. The thing that's key to understand is Judaism is not just a religion. That's actually a category error, because I can reject every aspect of Jewish religion right now. I can say I'm an atheist. I reject every aspect. I'm still a Jew because I was born to Jewish parents. Now, that's confusing. So, but we're not just an ethnicity. I said that before. Many Jewish ethnicities, we're certainly not a race. Jews are of many races. So what on earth are we? Peoplehood, tribe, nation, family, those are words. I mean, we predate the categories of race, ethnicity, and religion that define us today. And it's very confusing to people. So going back to my history, you know, we kind of decided, oh, no, we're not just a peoplehood, we're a religion, just like Christianity. Like, they have a church and we have a Jew church. It's our temple, our synagogue. You know, they pray to God in their church. We pray to God in ours. You know, they have the Old Testament. We do, too. But we also had all these other things that didn't really fit into a Protestant cookie cutter. And we kind of got rid of a lot of those things in an attempt to not be persecuted, right? An attempt to be safe and to assimilate. And I'm very grateful to my ancestors that they did this, because it did allow Jews to transition into the modern world. But, you know, some things were lost. And so I think, you know, as I look back at what was lost, I think what was lost was our textual tradition. You know, in Jewish tradition, studying the texts that include the wisdom of our ancestors, you know, there's a text called the Talmud, which is this 2-million-word epic. It's more like a library that kind of debates every aspect of Jewish law. And it's all these ancient rabbis debating. You know, it's not, you don't find a lot of answers. You find a lot of debates and questions, and it's quite a thing to study. You know, these 19th century Jews really de-emphasized that because, you know, Christians didn't really appreciate it and it didn't really fit that mold. But, you know, going back and reclaiming that, studying that wisdom has been incredibly profound for me. And for me, study is such a deep form of spiritual connection because it's my ancestors debating about the most important aspects of life. Like, how do we deal with birth, death? How do we care for each other? How do we care for those who are vulnerable? How do we, you know, honor the image of God within us? There are these very profound conversations. And as I'm studying this, I'm really hearing the echoes of the divine voice from, you know, Mount Sinai down through history. Think God came to a mountain and gave the Torah to people. No, I don't actually literally think that happened. I don't think the Torah is a history book. I don't think it's a scientific book. I think it's a sacred text. But, you know, I also think the story about the boy who cried wolf is still true in a profound sense, even if there was no actual boy who actually cried wolf, right? Like, these things are true in a deeper way than just factual. Like, these are sacred stories that we have made through, you know, we've sanctified them with our lives, with our studies, with our texts. So they are true in a spiritual sense, even if they may or may not be true in a literal sense.
Yeah, and I can't help but think, you know, when you say that there, I feel like there was probably a lost opportunity, and maybe it's not still lost. Maybe there's still an opportunity to be had there, where I feel like, you know, especially from my Christian perspective, like we start to have debates about the Bible.
Right.
And yet I think so many Christians forget that Christians didn't write the Bible. Jews wrote the Bible. Right. And yet we never consider the fact, well, why don't we ask them what they think about the text that they wrote? You know what I mean? And I think, you know, what you just described within Judaism is a lesson that we could learn in Christianity, which is that, like, letting go of this sort of need for certainty and being okay with not having all the answers, because this obsession with certainty is what I think has gotten so many American churches and Western churches into so much trouble. We have to have it all figured out, where within Judaism, within Midrash and the exercises of trying to find, you know, new revelations and beauty in the text, like wrestling with it alone, there's some beauty that's in that act, you know.
It is, you know, it's so funny. I have a wonderful friend who's a Presbyterian minister, and he's just brilliant. And he read drafts of my book and commented. And when I was first trying to understand the New Testament, I had a question. I was like, that's interesting. They seem to understand this word differently than I do. I wonder why. And I called him and asked him, and he called me back. He's like, okay, well, here's the deal. You have to understand that we kind of do interpret the Old Testament as being in some way about, you know, foreshadowing, being about the life of Jesus, like his birth and death and resurrection. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I was so surprised. I'm like, but it's not. And I stopped and I said, who am I to tell him what this book is about, right? We started as one people, right? We were a group of ancient Jews, and then we had disagreements about how to be Jewish, and some of us sort of stayed with the original Judaism, and some became followers of Jesus and Paul. And who am I to say that one is legitimate, one is not, right? Like, that's a different interpretation. They did a different midrash on the Bible than we did. And so I was like, oh, this is so interesting. I love this, right? This is a really beautiful thing that we've taken these two paths. I think where I struggle is where, you know, the universalist particularist balance gets off, right? Where there's sort of a universalist idea of like, there is one way to through salvation and it's this. That's where I kind of struggle, because it's like, well, okay, but what about, are all the other ways not okay, right? Are they not okay? And how do you tolerate other ways if there's really only one true way? And I think that's why I kind of like the Jewish balance of like, oh no, wait a second, everyone is created in God's image, period, right? We are all God's children. We are all sacred, holy, like, period. And like, here's how we do God. Here's how we do religion. And others are going to do it in different ways. And as long as they're observing some basic moral, you know, ethics, like, we're good. I think that's where I, you know, that's what's been challenging for me as I think about, like, how do you kind of balance these different traditions?
Yeah, and I think that's a thing that we've talked about a lot on the podcast over the years is this issue that I've always had with the one path, because it kind of paints a picture, like the ways in which we believe things like that really paint a picture of what we believe about God in general, which is to say that God is limited or has limitations in how he reaches, you know, God's children. And it's like, I just can't buy that. I believe in a God that's, you know, all powerful, and that would present limitations, you know. And
that's the thing. It's very tempting to kind of shrink the divine down to categories that our little human brains can comprehend. But to do that is to almost create a kind of idol, right? Because you're shrinking something infinite and ineffable down to human size that we can grasp with our little brains. And I think that can be very dangerous, right? I think that's where things start to go like a little bit wrong. Like when people are really confident that they know what God thinks, wants, feels, I'm like, ooh, yeah, I don't know. Just makes me a touch nervous. Makes me a touch nervous. Yeah.
By the way,
I also, you know, I worked with a minister once, and she just said to me very clearly, like, I am this denomination of Christianity, and I want my kids to be this denomination because I think it is the best. And here's why. And I just thought, yes, good for you. Right. You didn't tell me it's the only one or other ones are bad. You just said, like, this is what I think is best. And so I want it for my kids. And I thought, like, yeah, I have no problem with that. Right. You don't have to tell me that your thing is just the same as everything else and we're all equal. Like, you can actually love your thing more than others. That's OK, as long as you kind of respect that others have a thing, too, that is valid.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the best stories I ever heard, I was taking a seminary course years and years ago, and I'm sure people are sick of me telling this story, but it was such a profound impact on me. One of the projects was to write a paper on experience at the religious gathering of some kind. We were not allowed to go to a synagogue because it's too close to Christianity. So we had to go to something that was extremely different, very culture shocky moment. And so I was really kind of interested in Hinduism the more I read about it. And so I thought, this sounds really interesting. And so I went to a Hindu temple, and first of all, could not have been nicer folks. I was clearly the tallest, palest person there. I got like a sore thumb. And I know initially the woman who was I found it later, was the wife of the temple priest, was like looking back at me like, what is he doing? He's just standing with a notebook, you know? Like, what is this giant pasty guy doing? So she came back and I explained what I was doing. And she said, oh, come in. And first of all, they hand me a giant handful of mandarin orange slices. And I panicked Because we were told, like, you better know at least the basics before you walk in there. You don't want to offend them. And so take your shoes off, things like that. And I thought, oh, no, there's something that I was supposed to know that I don't. And within a few minutes realized, no, he was just giving me, like, out of the kindness of his heart, like, food, you know?
That's so lovely.
And then he's like, what do you want to know? And we sat down and he ended up telling me the story about their particular branch of Hinduism follows this particular sage, you know, and this guy allegedly said, whether it's true or not, it's beautiful in the message that it articulates. And what it was is, you know, there's this high ranking Hindu priest who's traveling, and he encounters throughout the story, he encounters individuals who came to him from different religions. One was a Christian, one was like from different religions, either way. Yeah. And they kept saying, like, I want to convert to Hinduism, all this stuff. And his message was always the same. He's like, no, go back and be the best Christian you can be. Mm. You believe, like, ignore the nonsense and, like, what are, you know, and get to the core tenets of that belief system, like, love others, be good to the poor, the, you know, do that and go be the best Christian. He wasn't trying to convert everyone like this, you know, manifest destiny conquest thing, but it was go be the best version of that you can be. And I thought,
I love that.
Wow. And it really humbled me in that moment, because I thought, if you walked into a Christian church today, I guarantee you they'd be selling you the package.
Right. And it's so funny. Growing up, I just assumed, oh, Judaism must do that because that's what religions do. And then I learned, like, no, we don't proselytize. It doesn't really make sense to proselytize, because that's like me saying, like, oh, John, you need to be a Hurwitz. You need to be part of the Hurwitz family. It's like, no, you have your own. Right? It's just like a category error mistake, right? This isn't. But people who want to become Jewish, of course, can convert, but they don't just take on the religion. They actually convert to being a member of the Jewish family. Like, they actually inherit the Jewish ancestors. It's sort of like marriage or adoption. It's a fascinating and very complicated thing. Yeah.
Does God have a face? Does he have a body or even a name? If he does he know that I'm alive? Is God even here? Does she care that I doubt? Does she care that I fear? Something tells look like yours. Did God kill his kid? Did he have to have blood before he would forgive? Maybe we made a God that looks like us. Face must look like yours.
Tina, and I met a Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children, face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome, a Pablo with legs he can't move by himself, a girl born a Daniel who now is Danielle, a Bill agent, even white guys named Todd. If you have a heartbeat, you are the face.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.